Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 28, 2019. South Sudan government shuts down an Arabic newspaper.
Every media has its own editorial guidelines. I hope that Al-Watan is operating within its editorial policies and guidelines. Media Authority also has its own guidelines. I presume they're also working within their rules and regulations.
And Rebecca Nyandeng signs the September peace deal.
I support the agreement because if my people of South Sudan, wanted this agreement, who am I to say no? And an individual, and peace is always for the people, not for individuals. So I support this agreement, and I have been there always, and the IGAD people, they are always involving me.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese journalist visiting the United States on the Edward Morrow Program for Journalists says there is a lot of negative reporting about South Sudan in the United States. Juma John Steven says the media environment in South Sudan has improved, adding that he has not heard of any reports of harassment of journalists by security operatives in Juba. Steven says the decision by the media authority to close down the Arabic Al-Watan newspaper this week should be reported in a professional manner.
Here in Washington, when you say you're from South Sudan, you think about that war-torn country, or people killed, or corruption, and so forth. We should also think about how we should report on issues that are positive. If corruption has happened, Al-Watan is closed, we need to go down to the issues that led to the closure of Al-Watan, and they should be resolved.
Let me bring you back to this issue of negative reporting. Do you agree with me that the war in South Sudan has killed people?
A lot.
And why should journalists not report about it if people have died?
I'm not saying they should not report about it. What I'm saying is that certain aspects of our reporting, we should take responsibility in the way we report. Tanzania, you're here in the U.S., and here I see some other things that didn't go well. Yesterday I was at the State Department, and we had also been speaking to people in leadership here within the media fraternity, and they've shared us some stories that myself I did not hear about, but they have not been reported.
Freedom of speech and freedom of expression comes with a responsibility. I agree with you on that. But it does not warrant you to be beaten, arrested, and, you know, killed.
No,
journalists who have lost their lives in South Sudan.
I know my friends that I've worked with, they have lost their lives, and some have even left the country. I know that very well. I never, ever wanted any journalist to be killed or to be beaten. We, in the national media security training that we had, JHR head with the security, positive things came out of that. The security agreed to work closely with the journalists, not to arrest, not to kill. If there's anything, they should cooperate with the media authority. The security will come to the media authority, and if there's anything, the journalists or the media houses will go to the media authority. So the media authority is the center between the journalists and the security. The media authority is the center. So you get the point.
My understanding of the formation of this media authority is that it is an independent institution. But the optics we are seeing from Juba, it's like the media authority has been hijacked.
You clearly mentioned it. The media authority was created to be an independent institute. And yes, it is. To tell you the truth, the people that work within the media authority, to me, they are professional.
They were appointed.
Yes, yes.
The job was not advertised. They were just handpicked.
I may not want to go deep into that, but I want to talk about the relationship between media authority and journalists for human rights and how we're able to observe them do their job.
But the issue with Al-Watan was that Al-Watan is reporting on the protest in Sudan. Why should the media authority prevent a newspaper from reporting on what is happening in the neighboring country?
For me, I want to be very objective here, that any journalist who is reporting or having an opinion, we should be objective in everything that we do. Objectivity is key.
Your understanding of the media authority is they are more of a judge than a regulator. Is that what you're telling me?
What do you mean, judge?
I mean, you are looking at them like a court.
They are both. They are judging the media and judging the security.
Why should they judge the media? I mean, the media is free to do its work, and every media station is responsible for its mistakes.
That is exactly what it is supposed to be.
But why should you go through another group?
I've been here is it almost coming to a week in Washington, D.C.? In Washington, D.C. or in the U.S., that's how it is. Speak freely if there's anything. Somebody takes you to court. But at least for my colleagues in other African countries that we have been discussing, there's always a regulator in any African country. There's a media regulator.
Yeah, I agree with you that there is a media regulator. There is a
media regulator.
The media regulator should not be a court. What you're telling me is the work of the media authority in South Sudan, it's as if they are the judge, the regulator.
No. What I'm telling you is this. What I'm telling you is the media authority in South Sudan, it makes sure that the media is protected in South Sudan. It has been like 2 or 3 years. There's never been any journalist arrested, no journalist in prison, which is a success, my dear. If the media authority has done a mistake, we need to examine. If Al-Watan has done a mistake, we need to examine.
But if Al-Watan has broken any law, the place for Al-Watan is the court of law. It is the judiciary, the court, to issue a closure.
Yeah, you're right.
That is how it's done.
Yeah, every media has its own editorial guidelines. I hope that Al-Watan is operating within its editorial policies and guidelines. Media authority also has its own guidelines. I presume they're also working within their rules and regulations.
That's Juma John Stephen, executive director of the Juba-based nonprofit Journalist for Human Rights. He was speaking to me here in Washington earlier today. A senior opposition politician associated with the former detainees tells South Sudan's leaders that they don't own the country and should realize their power is not permanent. Rebecca Nyandeng signed the revitalized peace deal a little more than a month before the deadline for formation of the transitional government of national unity. Nyandeng says she wants to take part in the implementation of the agreement. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Rebecca Nyandeng, the widow of South Sudan's founding father, John Garang, signed a peace deal in Juba at her home today in the presence of IGAD special envoy Ismael Weiss. Nyandeng says since the agreement has been accepted by the people of South Sudan, it is important that she come on board.
Just my signature, which was not there in the agreement because I didn't go to Khartoum at that time to sign the agreement. And if my signature is not there, the people of South Sudan will say that the agreement is incomplete. Why is Mama's name is not there? Yes, I support the agreement because if my people of South Sudan, wanted this agreement, who am I to say no? And an individual, and peace is always for the people, not for individuals. So I support this agreement, and I have been there always. And the IGAD people, they are always involving me, and I wanted to see the light at the end of the tunnel for the people of South Sudan.
Nyandeng says she believes the agreement will restore peace in South Sudan if its leaders work for the good of the country and its people.
I have fears because the problem with us as leaders, we don't accept ourselves. We need to accept ourselves and know that there is challenge. The people and our supporters are looking at us. So we need to come into the presidency as the leaders of the people of South Sudan. We have to do our job, not as parties, but as the leaders of the people. When we need parties, when we go, we need vehicle for the party, when we go for election. But when we want to serve people of South Sudan,
keeping in mind that the peace deals have been signed and broken many times before in South Sudan, Nyandeng says this time around the people want their leaders to focus on restoring stability rather than clinging to power when ordinary citizens continue to suffer as they have in the past.
The leaders of South Sudan must know that they don't own the people nor the country. Not even their life, the one they breathe, you don't own it. God is the one who gives us that. My expectation, I wanted to see peace and to see my people embracing one another as one people created by God, because God created us in his own image, not as tribes.
Information Minister Michael Makwe said last week that the parties to the agreement are determined to form a transitional government of national unity at the end of the pre-transitional period in May and allow SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar to return to Juba and resume his role as first vice president. But SPLM-IO officials say the new government should not be formed until security arrangements are fully implemented as laid out in the September peace deal. Many of those arrangements have not yet been carried out. IGAD Special Envoy to South Sudan Ismail Weis says the decision on whether to form the new government on time will be determined by the people.
The decision whether we form the Artegano or whether we postpone it and what not, this will be really the decision of the South Sudanese people themselves. And I think we should also, as far as we are concerned, the region and the international community, we should respect that.
Weis agrees that several terms of the agreement have yet to be accomplished during the pre-transitional period and time is running out. He says if the parties fail to implement the security arrangements, one option is that the parties agree to go into the transitional period and implement the pending activities during that time period. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Residents and civil society activists in the Jonglei State capital Bor claim soldiers deployed in the town have been harassing civilians. Jonglei Information Minister says officials are investigating the claims. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Jonglei State officials deployed a joint operation force to Bor town a few months ago to restore law and order after civilians killed three policemen last November. The force includes police, government soldiers, and South Sudan National Security Service agents. But civil society activists and residents say rather than keeping the peace, security forces are abusing civilians. Juke Othana Mading is the executive director of a board-based advocacy group, Jonglei Institute for Peace, Democracy and Development.
There are people in uniform who used to operate at night and looted people's properties like phones and small money in the pocket at around 9 to 10 at evening hours. I can say those are abuses by the security agents against the civilian right are still continuing.
Mading says last weekend, a South Sudan People's Defense Force soldier opened fire on a group of students, killing one student and injuring another.
It was so sad and we condemn our civil society. So we also urge government to respond, to respect the right of the citizen and especially the civilian to separate them from the security agent. Take the security agent to their location, to their barracks.
One Bor resident who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals from the army says one of the soldiers stole his smartphone and took money from him 2 weeks ago.
They held two guns against my head, and that is what they were doing all along. So when they released me, they told me to go straight away to the direction that I came from. They asked me not to look back at them after they have asked me whether I know them or not, and I replied that I did not know them. I came back to the main road and I realized that these guys were really they were military guys. They were in a uniform, and I could not recognize them because it was too dark.
Residents are demanding authorities investigate the matter. Jonglei State Information Minister Atong Kwol confirms the state has received multiple complaints about security agents.
I believe these are genuine cases. Probably most of them are genuine cases. But what was not clear was the fact that there could be other people also who have joined in the harassment of our civilian also. There has to be probably other people who are also doing that. But this is not to say that the national security are not doing that.
Kwol says the state is investigating the matter and will arrest and prosecute any soldiers accused of abusing civilians.
If there are cases like that, then of course the government doesn't take that lightly, because at the end of the day, it comes out that the government is not doing what it's supposed to do to protect the citizen.
Kwol says soldiers' abuse of civilians does not represent a good image of the government. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng, reporting from Bor.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at efforts to bring stability back to Libya. That story is coming up next.
do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you smile?
What makes me to smile is that whenever I am happy, I must express my feeling in terms of smiling.
When I see my friend is happy, and if he or she doesn't have any problem, I always do feel happy, and I will smile. It is also an answer for him to know that I'm happy because of his or her situation.
What makes me smile is, when there's something so funny, when there's some funny things happening, amused you, actually, you need to smile.
Something funny. When I hear something funny, yeah, that's it.
I'm just a joyful person, and mostly what makes me smile is if what I am doing has given me an achievement.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations mission in Libya is preparing to hold a national conference next month to draw up a roadmap to end the Libyan crisis. About 150 delegates representing all political categories will attend. The delegates are expected to determine when to hold the parliamentary and presidential elections and to try reach decisions on a new Libyan constitution. The UN mission says both the government of National Accord, headed by Faiz al-Sarraj, and the commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, agreed to end the transitional phase through general elections. Ranyon Smith, managing editor of the Libyan Analysis website in London, tells VOA's Mohammed al-Ashnawi about the prospects of reaching a political solution through this conference.
I think this could be a significant step forward. Problems we've seen in Libya over the previous years in terms of trying to find a political dialogue and a political solution have been that they are top-down, so implemented from the international community out or from the leadership, the sort of political leadership down, but haven't really had any impact on the ground. This format has the potential to kind of overcome some of those boundaries, bring together a wide range of Libyans and actually come up with some Libyan-led solutions that also will work and reflect the realities on the ground. There are still many things that could go wrong. There are many groups that are likely to be hostile to this event potentially, but I think the fact that we've got the main actors on board, I think this could be a positive platform to really have some positive change in the near future.
The planned national conference would also determine when to hold parliamentary and presidential elections and would try to reach decisions on a new Libyan constitution. What could make or break a consensus on these important issues?
This is a very important question. So the issues that you've highlighted there are ones that have been very divisive and undecided in sort of Libyan political process for many years. So these are not issues that are going to be overcome or, you know, decided easily. That doesn't mean it's impossible, however. If I sort of go through and say the parliamentary elections, this is probably the least controversial and actually least challenging of those aspects, because Libya has already had parliamentary elections. In theory, the current sort of elected body, which is the House of Representatives, their mandate ran out quite a long time ago. So, and you know, there is this precedent for having these kind of elections. So I think this will be the easiest one to push forward with. That said, as I mentioned there, the House of Representatives and some of the already kind of elected officials may try to prevent this from happening, because that will mean they lose their own power. So again, there will be challenges along the way. The presidential elections are probably the most controversial. Now, this is because whoever is elected as president will hold a huge amount of power. And one of the key areas of disagreement over this is how much power that individual will have. Will the president also act as the supreme commander of the army? And many people are worried that if that's the case, we could see another sort of Gaddafi figure, another dictator. And many people in Western Libya are afraid that Khalifa Haftar would take on this role. Now, there are reports that the way around is the way that the National Conference is thinking of moving past this is actually have a three-person presidential council, a bit like what exists at the moment, with Haftar, Faiz al-Sarraj, the current prime minister, and another representative from the south of Libya to kind of move past that issue and try and find some compromise. And finally, on the constitution, this falls into two main camps: people that want to have a constitution approved before the elections and those that think it should wait until after. Again, this is not an easy one to solve. So there is a process at the moment. There is a draft constitution and there is legislation to hold a referendum on that. But it's hard to see how that will happen in enough time. And many people are unhappy with the current draft, and so it's unlikely to pass. So this will be another key thorny issue. I suspect the easiest way will be to delay it until after elections. But again, these are all points that they will need to discuss. So although the National Conference is positive, it's definitely a positive move, there's a lot to move past in order to have real change and implementation in the process on the ground. In order for any solution, political way forward in Libya to work and to actually bring some peace and stability to the country, it needs to have the acceptance, the participation of some of the key militias and other actors, sort of social and tribal actors on the ground. So I think the idea is that the Haftar and Sarraj are leading the way, but actually it needs the participation of all these other actors through the National Conference to be able to actually agree something that could actually work and could provide a solution for the future in Libya.
That was Ranon Smith with the Libyan analysis in London, speaking with my colleague Muhammad Al-Ashinawi. Aid agencies continue to push to get aid to victims of Cyclone Idai in Mozambique, Zimbabwe and Malawi. In Mozambique, the government and aid workers are rushing to set up cholera treatment centers to prevent the spread of the potential deadly waterborne disease. Vaccination programs are being sent into motion.
At Machongwe village in Zimbabwe's Chimanimani district, the area west hit by Cyclone Idai, people wait as officials prepare food. Cornmeal has run out, but authorities say other food is being distributed. Coming here has become a daily routine for many since the disaster hit on March 16, including Susan Makuza. She takes care of five children whose parents died in the cyclone. Poverty has struck us, says Makuza. Our maize crops were swept away with the river. Our survival is at risk and we do not know what to do, she says. We came to receive food, but we were not given any and our houses went down the river. We are sleeping outside, says Makuza, adding that I was kindly asking for help. That is the same for 81-year-old Wamizai Matamande. There's really hunger here, says Matamande, because Cyclone Idai damaged our granaries. So we are frequenting this place hoping to get something like cornmeal. But I have not received anything, says Matamande. Lloyd Kasima is the acting district administrator for Chimanimani. He told United Nations officials assessing the situation that the government was aware of the villagers' struggle. He said after Cyclone Idai hit, more than 7,000 people were left homeless, while more than 40,000 people have no food.
But at the moment, the distribution is quite slow because of transport problems. But at the moment, there are some people, the Chinese contractors, who are at least trying to open our usual road. We have seen that they are making progress.
Bo Victor Neland is the Deputy Regional Director for the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. He says UNICEF is setting up a temporary rehabilitation center at Ngangu School for children traumatized by Cyclone Idai. UNICEF is seeking aid to help Malawi, Mozambique and Zimbabwe address children's health, sanitation and education concerns in the wake of the cyclone.
Globally, for the three countries, it's going to be about 150 million that we're appealing. That's about the calculation at the moment. But we're also still discovering, because some of the areas are inaccessible.
Acting UN representative in Zimbabwe, Esther Muiya, says Harare is doing its best to cope given the scale of the needs.
There's still a lot of gaps. Most people lost all their food,
And you know, there was an impending drought already in Manicaland, and the cyclone has actually compounded the whole situation. The waterways have been destroyed completely. People do not have clean, safe water for drinking, and that's a big priority at the moment.
The European Union has funded a World Food Programme-owned helicopter to bring in UNICEF equipment and chemicals to prevent waterborne diseases. Villagers here hope donors will soon provide funds for airlifting much-needed food to the thousands of people left struggling to survive. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chimanimani, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The widow of South Sudan's founding father, John Garang, has signed the September peace deal. Rebecca Nyandeng, a high-profile South Sudanese politician in her own right, says the country's leaders should understand that they don't own South Sudan and should also realize that their power is not permanent. Nyandeng signed the deal a little more than a month before the deadline for forming a transitional government of national unity. She said she didn't sign the peace deal because she was not in Khartoum at the time. She says she wants to take part in the new transitional government, adding peace is always for the people, not an individual. A South Sudanese journalist visiting the U.S. on the Edward Murrow Program for Journalists says there's a significant amount of negative reporting about South Sudan in the U.S. Juma John Stevens says when people hear South Sudan, they think of, quote, that war-torn country or corruption. But Stephen says they should also report on positive issues occurring in the country. He says the media environment has improved and says he has heard of no recent reports of harassment of journalists by security operatives in Juba. And finally, residents and civil society activists in the Jonglei State Capital Bor say soldiers deployed in the town have harassed civilians rather than protect them. Jonglei officials deployed a joint operations force of police, soldiers and national security agents to Bor a few months ago to restore law and order after civilians killed three policemen last November. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Thursday. And we now leave you with the song Ayan Ta Mohabba by Sultan Clinton.
Ayan Ta Mohabba. Binere Jemi, Namana Sato Kana Waka Waka Besado. Ni Amanga, Malaik. Simplice Nazato Kana Tilichi.
Excuse me, lady, what's your name? Miss Acholi Sintakimono. Abuta kimono,
abuta kimono,
mote mananga, oh oh oh, na lingi yo,
oh mama, yeah, oh mama, bini ya doko tumele matai pop chadi, ana maro kusaka na bika bamu na moresu, gisitani kama gisitani
na tabani etama zahere, ana geni stena fisika leta bika tapulu yomo. Ana pika bumonu supara wana kala motuno Itakani magi sete kuwana asalu minyo kasa Kani tadero sumanesia asalu kalona sasa Iye 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 anati mongoti Lugadai iye anati mongoti Ile
We have been listening to Sultan Clinton with that song, Ayan Ta Mohabba. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Kanita mabise de luana asalu inkonga Nebespe yuliana one time e motema Nenyu periho karogi keda nyaga e hallelujah Abek mi papa mi mama waiting to see